Put down that bottle of disinfectant and stop disassembling your Corby trouser press. It's the second lockdown edition of Flat Chat. For those of you who are allowed out to the shops, there's a new edition of GP Racing magazine on the shelves. Subscribers should have received their copies last week. It should have carried race reports from China, Vietnam and the Netherlands. Instead, it's our first issue produced fully under lockdown. And if you're still under lockdown, you can order it online from... I've completely forgotten the website because...
magsdirect.co.uk.
Magsdirect.co.uk. Thank you, Ben Anderson, guest number one today. Magsdirect.co.uk. Yes, you can order yourself a copy of GP Racing and have it delivered in plastic direct to your door. We've assembled a prime cut of Formula One entertainment and erudition, as people who listen to Just a Minute are used to hearing. Joining me to walk through the well-stocked aisles of this month's GP Racing are Mark Gallagher. Hello, Mark.
Hello. Nice to talk to you again.
And you, fresh from talking to Mika Häkkinen.
Yeah, just a very, very interesting chat with him this morning about lots of unexpected topics. The main one being his 1964 Ford Galaxy convertible, which he bought in Finland, kind of on the spur of the moment. And I love his story about the fact that when he went into the dealership and said, "How much is the car?" the guy immediately put the price up.
He might have seen him coming.
Because, and I said, and that was just because you were Mika Häkkinen. And he said, exactly. He said he wasn't even shy about it. He just went, "Oh, multimillionaire has just come into my dealership. I'm going to put the price of that car up." Anyway, he bought this convertible. And then the dealer said, "But look, I'll throw in delivering it to you in Monaco from Finland." Pew. Which is a pretty good deal, really. So he gets this. And he said the kids absolutely love it, and I think it might be as a result of the next point that he made, which is it has no seatbelts.
So this was before Ralph Nader got to the American car industry.
It just has big bench seats, so the kids all pile in. There's no safety whatsoever. They're being driven by Mika Häkkinen, but he swears that he doesn't speed in it, and doesn't know whether it has high or low speed, understeer or oversteer or anything like that. He says he doesn't push it because it has, I think, the suspension of...
Sofa.
So I was about to say a sofa bed.
He's a sensible old man now.
Yeah, exactly. So, well, no, don't say that. He was telling me about his desire to come back to racing, although not Formula One, I should say.
We should properly introduce our second guest, or number one guest, with his great knowledge of URLs from which one can obtain magazines. MagsDirect.co.uk is representative in the house and editor of GP Racing, Ben Anderson. Hello, Ben.
Hello. Good to see you haven't gone entirely mad during lockdown, Codders.
It's getting
that,
there.
What's that magazine URL again?
MagsDirect.co.uk.
We'll all have to make a note of that.
Yeah, if you can't get to the shops, it's an option open to you, dear readers.
Yeah, it's we're going to be doing it subliminally. So if, for instance, magsdirect.co.uk, you hadn't already got hold of that magsdirect.co.uk URL, we might just occasionally magsdirect.co.uk drop it into the magsdirect.co.uk conversation.
Busy couple of weeks. This is out, isn't it?
This is podcast Martin's wielding the knife. He's like a chef sharpening his sword. Besides us going lula in lockdown, it's been a busy couple of weeks for development in the Formula One world. Once again, we've been eerily prescient with our finger on the pulse. Charles Leclerc is the subject of our cover feature. We look into how he ousted Sebastian Vettel as Ferrari's favourite son. And then just as the copies of the magazine were beginning to thud onto subscribers' doormats and indeed arrive on the virtual shelves of magsdirect.co.uk, we learned that it's now official and Sebastian Vettel is off at the end of this season and will be replaced at Ferrari by Carlos Sainz. So is this a science of the times or...
That's awful.
And they don't get any better. And I hadn't actually prepared any comedy for this edition.
You mean you do previously?
This is what's known as his writer's strike material.
Yeah, Ed Straw referred to my humour as the writer's strike material. And my nephew, interestingly, watches the Autosport pub quiz I host on the Autosport YouTube channel on a Friday night, and he says he can tell when I'm deliberately saying things that will trigger some of the angry people in the comments. So he can see the little twinkle in my eyes. I say something that will really trigger them.
Give the anyway, people what they want, Connors.
It's been a busy week for the agents, and it all seems to have come together pretty quickly, because just to peek behind the curtain and witness the machinations of the smoke machine, we were actually going to be interviewing Daniel Ricciardo for a feature, and we had a choice of whether to do it Wednesday or Thursday, and Ben couldn't do it on Wednesday, and if he had been able to do it, we would have got the interview in the bag, because obviously on Thursday Contractageddon happened, and he seemed to seismically fall out with Renault, or at least Cyril Abitbol came out with quite a bitchy soundbite about loyalty and whatnot. So, chaps, what do we make of that?
It was a pretty rapid turn of events, but albeit, I think we now know that it had been in the pipeline for quite a while. And so, really, just as the teams were coming up towards the end of lockdown, they obviously decided this was a time to go public with those machinations that had already been in the pipeline during the winter. I felt quite sorry to read about Seb and Ferrari, because it's a kind of final denouement, isn't it, for Sebastian's Ferrari dream. And it was kind of falling apart at the seams fairly slowly, going back a couple of years, really. But the speed with which it came apart was accelerated by, of course, his young teammate, Charles Leclerc. And in the end, it's been pretty tragic. And I have to say, again, you know, you mentioned about the fact that I was chatting to Mika Häkkinen this morning. Mika was saying to me that he thinks it's really sad that Sebastian, for example, is not on social media, because he thinks that, you know, one of the things which undoubtedly affects a driver is if all you read is negativity about you. And he said the media have been pretty consistently negative about Sebastian's performances for quite some time. And a difficulty with that kind of negative narrative is that actually everyone in the industry picks up on it, including the team you drive for and teams that you might like to drive for, because they all are fed this kind of storyline that you're making mistakes all the time. So Mika made the interesting point, if Sebastian was on social media in the way that, frankly, everyone else is, there'd be an opportunity for him to have a voice about maybe some of the mistakes he has made in the past, and his passion for the sport, and actually show what a great guy he is. So Mika's sort of view on it was, it is a real pity. He's probably a slightly misunderstood guy, and it would be a shame if Formula One loses him.
Yeah, it would be a shame. I think he's still got a lot to offer. You know, he's not reached retirement age yet. You know, as he said in an interview which he gave from lockdown last month, that's carried in this issue of GP racing. You know, he wanted to stay with Ferrari. They're in negotiations, but he made a couple of telling points, I thought. One of which was he wanted to feel comfortable with the terms and whatever deal that they could potentially agree. And he mentioned explicitly that his previous contracts with the team had been for 3 years at a time. So you got the impression that he was expecting to get at least a 3-year deal, and, you know, probably similar terms to what he was on before. You know, he's a 4-time world champion. He claims, obviously, money's not really a factor, but it always is in these things. But, of course, his value has diminished. He came into Ferrari as a 4-time champion, but last season he didn't drive like a 4-time world champion. He didn't necessarily behave with the dignity of a 4-time world champion on the track either. And all the while, you've got this young hotshot coming through who's stunned everyone, including his own team, with how quickly and impressively he's progressed. They've then signed that guy up to a longer, we presume more lucrative for him, contract. And then suddenly the world gets hit by this pandemic, and all the teams, as we'll get to later, are struggling with that and adjusting to perhaps a new financial reality being imposed on them. Ferrari holding all the cards then. You know, I'm sure they happily keep Vettel if he bucks his ideas up, if he maintains team harmony and, you know, learns from some of those incidents we saw last season, particularly in Brazil. But you're not necessarily going to offer him the same kind of contractual terms that you did at the start. And I'm guessing that Sebastian, considering his pedigree and background in Formula One, was probably a bit too proud to do a Kimi Raikkonen and just cruise and collect the paycheck.
There will be people triggered by your use of the word cruise and collect, so batten down the hatches, Ben. It must be pretty difficult when you're a driver who is used to dictating terms and having multi-year contracts to then be in a situation where you're much younger teammate with much less of a pedigree is given the mother of all contract extensions, and you're told it's either a year or a year with an option for another year depending on how it goes, and you know, Mark, you've worked with drivers and contracts before, they are phenomenally competitive with each other when it comes to contracts as well, aren't they, and even down to the small print of how many PR days they have to do and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, I've seen contracts where drivers have requested the kind of food that they're served in the motorhome, and they have to have a distinct area for their masseur to come and look after them, and lots of detail gets worked through. But of course, the big picture is that dynamic in terms of who's the lead driver, who's the second driver, is there supposed equality, is there real equality? And going right back to December, when Charles Leclerc was confirmed at Ferrari until the end of 2024, the writing was on the wall on that day for Sebastian Vettel, because even if he was going to get a new 3-year contract, it wouldn't be as long as the contract that had just been announced for his young teammate. And from that moment onwards, it was clear that he was going to, at the very least, be on the back foot going into those negotiations. And to be brutal, Charles Leclerc blew him away last year at the end. There was a slow start, and Charles has admitted that in the first few races he was trying to adapt to the car, and then he finally learned how to get the team to adapt the car for him, how to give him what he needed from his car in order to give him the confidence. And from then on, he didn't really look back. And things like, you know, if you're going to win back-to-back races, Spa and Monza are absolutely the places to do it, aren't they, as a Ferrari driver? So Charles had really done everything that he possibly could to make life difficult for Sebastian. And in a sport where really your ultimate rival is your teammate, Charles did the perfect job. So Sebastian, he was going into those negotiations in a difficult position. And as other people have said as well recently, I spoke to David Coulthard about this, because David and I have spoken on a few occasions in the past about contracts, all the way back to when he did his first contract at Red Bull Racing. And, you know, point that DC made was that he had a manager. So he had Martin Brundle. And he said Martin Brundle quite often used to say to me, "I'm sorry, DC, you're wrong about that, or you're misguided, or you have the wrong idea about that." And he said, "I respected Martin." And so he said, quite often as a driver, you start to, you know, either believe what you're telling yourself, or you start to believe what, you know, sycophants around you are telling you about yourself. He said, having someone like Martin turn up and say, "Actually, you're wrong, and you have to be very careful here because you're going to lose control, and the contract has to be handled in the right way." DC's point was that was extremely important, and that, you know, Sebastian hasn't surrounded himself perhaps with the best structure. If you've got too many people who are essentially yes men following your lead, what's to say that you know all the angles? And that's why, you know, you only have to spend 5 minutes talking to a really experienced Formula One manager like Julian Jacoby to really understand that there are so many facets to what's involved in managing a driver's career at every stage, through all the pressures and the ups and downs. And if you don't have that professional manager looking right to the horizon for the best, you know, to give you the best opportunity for your career, as a driver, you will quite often trip yourself up, because too many drivers, well, all drivers are focused relatively short term. And when they suddenly come up for air and try to do a contract, they can often just misstep and get it wrong.
Yeah, because Sebastian looks after his own affairs, really, doesn't he? Whereas Charles Leclerc has Nicholas Todd, who's very plugged into Ferrari. Daniel Ricciardo's recently changed management. Obviously, Carlos Sainz, the other big mover of this sort of switcheroo, has his dad and his cousin looking after his affairs, and they seem to be very, very knowledgeable. But also, they have that sort of familial relationship that enables them to bounce off one another. So I suppose, given given that Andrew Benson's tied off the Leclerc angle very nicely in the current issue of GP Racing, available from magsdirect.co.uk if you can't get to the shops, maybe have a little talk about Carlos Sainz and Daniel Ricciardo. How teed up were those things? Was it the case of dominoes waiting or dominoes ready to fall once Vettel had been given that final nudge? They must have been in discussions with someone for this to happen so quickly after that had happened.
Yeah, you'd imagine so. Certainly the sequence suggested that all the ducks were in a row, as it were. And of course, from Ferrari's point of view, I mean, we almost certainly know we're offering Vettel reduced terms compared to what he was on before. So when you're going into a negotiation, essentially asking someone to lower themselves, you've got to have a plan B, because it's not like you're giving him everything he wants and saying, oh, we love you, you're great, you know, here's a pay rise, here's the same terms as your teammate. They're saying, you know, this is our guy. If you want to come along for the ride, that's fine. And Vettel chose not to. So Sainz is a good fit, really, because he doesn't have the same history, baggage, probably not the same pay demands as a four-time world champion. You know, he's not yet had his shot at an absolute top team. He got Max Verstappen out of the Red Bull system. And this, if Ferrari can get their act together, is his chance to have another crack at Max, isn't it? So he can go into it with kind of nothing to lose. He'll happily take the 1+1 if that was what was on offer for Seb, because he'll back himself to prove that he can do it. He's got time to prove it. Whereas Vettel's coming at it from a very different place. Obviously, people link Daniel Ricciardo to that seat as well, because he's been linked to the Ferrari rumour mill in the past. But of course, you know, he, as we well know from the legal dispute he had with his former manager, was on a very, very lucrative contract with Renault. And you can see the top teams, with Red Bull coming out saying it's very unlikely that Seb will land back there, because they also signed Max Verstappen up to a long-term lucrative contract. They can't afford to pay two top drivers two massive salaries to race for them, especially the way the economy's going. So you need to kind of readjust your horizons a bit. And, you know, that's where a driver like Sainz, who, as I say, hasn't yet had that top team chance, the stars align for him. Daniel Ricciardo would have probably had to take a massive pay cut to go to Ferrari. And of course, he also introduced the potential Verstappen-Ricciardo dynamic that you had at Red Bull previously, which is kind of two alphas or one alpha, one half alpha, however you want to look at it, jutting up against each other. Whereas Ferrari have just come off a season where they had two alpha drivers butting heads, causing havoc. This is a chance for Mattia Binotto to take the Toto Wolff post-Nico Rosberg approach, which is to emphasise team unity, team harmony, and have everyone pushing in one direction towards the opposition rather than fighting a civil war inside Maranello.
So are we saying then that Carlos Sainz is not an alpha driver in terms of, you know, his ability to take the fight to Charles? Because it is really interesting, isn't it? You've got essentially the guy that we all see as team leader, Charles Leclerc. He's only been in Formula One for 2 years. He's only been with Ferrari for 1 year. And then you've got Carlos coming in with 5 years' experience. I mean, arguably, the team should be looking to him and his experience, but yet we all know that it'll be Charles who'll be, you know, pushing from the front. That dynamic is going to be so interesting. It's either going to work out beautifully and be the making of Carlos Sainz, where he goes in and gives Charles a hard time and everyone's like, wow, Sainz is really, really good. Or he gets pasted by Charles, in which case it could be a pretty uncomfortable experience for Carlos. But if he's anything like a chip off the old block, and I suspect he is, I mean, if he's anything like his dad, that formidable science, competitive instinct, mentality, work ethic as well, just the ability to work away at it, it'll be really interesting to see. But extraordinary to think of Ferrari going into, you know, 2021 with a lineup like Leclerc and Sainz. You know, gone are the old conservative Ferrari ways, and we've got all this young blood. It's very exciting.
You've really tripped me up there, Mark. You've really tripped me up with the alpha comment. I mean, it's a fair point. I suppose Sainz is not yet a proven alpha in the sense that, you know, he hasn't gone in and pasted a world champion driver who's, you know, been at the top of the sport for a long time. But he could be an alpha in waiting. This is the gamble, isn't it? You know, I'm not trying to paint Sainz as a kind of, you know, easy ride number two driver with no chance of being successful. There's every chance that they could not get on. I mean, he and Max, you know, they came to blows a bit internally at Toro Rosso in their first season, and that was part of the thinking behind promoting Max so soon and getting him out of that Toro Rosso environment. So it could blow up in Ferrari's face, but I mean, it couldn't really get any worse after last year, could it?
No. The other thing that Ferrari faces and is another angle that we've covered in the current edition of GP Racing, available via magsdirect.co.uk.
I'll stop it.
We have covered off the angle of Ferrari's car in the current issue, which is in a slightly suboptimal position. So given the likely limited development that teams will be able to perform on their cars through this year, if we ever do get going, and next year, it was looking as if the 2020 Ferrari was carrying quite a few compromises still in terms of performance. So in that case, you know, maybe we are looking at yet another an interim year, as sports people like to call it. But if those weaknesses are baked in, it could be two interim seasons.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? When all the news broke last week, there was some trolley-type fan who said, oh, well, Ferrari have signed Sainz because Ferrari realised their car is rubbish, so they thought they'd go and get a cheap driver who's not very good to be teammate to Charles Leclerc. Ooh. And I just thought, wow. I'm sure if I'd continued to read the thread, it probably had something to do with 5G and COVID-19 as well being part of the problem.
And hydroxychloroquine. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. It's all tied together. Lovely conspiracy theory. But yeah, it is a headache for Ferrari. And again, we've had this bizarre kind of paused period where the whole industry just can't do anything. There's been a 63-day lockdown or 65-day lockdown in terms of factory closures, and literally for the teams to go from pre-season testing in Barcelona back in February to a first race in Austria, it's a headache for Ferrari, and they're going to have to come out fighting with some pretty rapid work if they're to make anything of it. And particularly if the season ends up being, as I think many of us suspect, quite a short season and a very compressed season. So with not many breaks between races. So you could end up with a very short, punchy season, which essentially means that the car you start the season with in Austria in July is essentially going to be very much the car you finish with, which means that, you know, Ferrari just aren't going to get that room for improvement. I can't believe that if they do have some fundamental issues, that they will not pull out all the stops to rectify that for next year, Ferrari being Ferrari, and they're having the resources that they do have, budget cap or no budget cap.
But their room for manoeuvre is reduced, isn't it? That's the problem. I mean, yeah. I'm in Cotter's excellent feature on the car. You mentioned that Mattia Binotto emailed the Ferrari rank and file to say, don't expect us to be in the victory hunt in Melbourne, obviously before then the whole season got paused. So they weren't optimistic about their chances. People were talking about maybe even Racing Point's pink Mercedes, as it's known, giving them a challenge from behind. And now the rules are frozen. I think Ferrari, that wasn't really in their interest. They acknowledged that much, and they've kind of gone along with the majority for the good of Formula One and to the detriment of their own interests. Even with that big budget, the specs of the cars are frozen to a large extent. There is some development going to be allowed. They're obviously negotiating that, but it will be reduced compared to what you're used to. So how Ferrari adds to performance to that car this season, it's almost impossible if we have a season. Next season, okay, there might be a bit more time, but not necessarily the avenues that you can explore. So they kind of are locked into 2 years of whatever this basic concept can give you. Added to that, you have this driver market upheaval and Mattia Binotto within that acknowledging that Ferrari's kind of having a reset. I thought it was interesting the comments he made, having signed Sainz, that, you know, they're signing their youngest or deploying their youngest ever driver pairing. And they realise actually they need a big recalibration, you know, that they haven't really built on the promise of 2017 and 2018. They've taken a big backward step. They're not going to make real progress in 2020 or 2021 now. So it's all about, again, the new rules, isn't it, in 2022 and trying to work out how you come back stronger.
Obviously, it's very tricky situation and constantly evolving at the moment. But in amongst all this change, we do seem to be edging towards the resumption of racing in some way, shape or form. Now, at the risk at the risk of triggering the people out there who've had enough of experts, Mark, your column this month is about the challenges the teams have been facing financially since Formula One closed for business on March the 13th. So yeah, there've been reports of McLaren seeking alternative funding of some sort. So I suppose the question we need to ask now is, assuming racing does restart at the beginning of July in Austria, is that soon enough for the teams that are struggling? And for how long, given the way that the payments are structured from Formula One itself, how long will those that remain be feeling the effects of that hiatus?
Well, I think if racing starts this summer in July, it's going to be good news for everyone, because the teams will then be able to secure payments from their sponsors and drivers where they have paid drivers. It's very good for Formula One because Liberty will be able to charge their broadcasters and the championship sponsors because the events are taking place. So even if they're not getting revenue from the race promoters, at least there is a pipeline of money coming into Formula One. And I think this is one of the interesting things about the coronavirus crisis, is that its impact on 2020 has been very clear already in terms of races not taking place. But in terms of the prize fund this year, well, the prize fund this year is funded from what happened last year, and the teams are receiving prize money this year from the pot generated last year. So at least the teams are getting money from Liberty, and Liberty produced a pretty spectacular switch around in terms of assets within their companies, which poured $1.5 billion of cash into the Formula One system just about a month ago. So there is money in the system for this year. The real struggle is going to be having money in the system for next year, because if you end up with a much reduced championship, and particularly with no event revenues coming in this year, it means that the prize fund that will be available in 2021 is going to be much reduced, and teams could be looking at getting, you know, effectively half the money or less than half the money that is available this year. And this is why the budget cap takes on such an important it becomes such an important matter, because it's one thing about tightening our belts today. The belt tightening is going to have to continue long after the coronavirus has gone away. Hopefully that it will have gone away, because 2021 is definitely massively compromised, and goodness knows it may continue beyond that. Because if we do have, for example, a second wave of coronavirus in any of the countries which host Grand Prix during the winter, during the Northern Hemisphere winter, I'm not being pessimistic, but I'm just saying it's not completely impossible that there isn't a vaccine by 2021 that could continue to be an impact, particularly on spectator attendance at events next year. So this is a crisis that's going to run and run. And, you know, in Ben's introduction, you know, he talks about Claire Williams suggesting that her team won't survive if there isn't racing this year. You mentioned McLaren looking for funding. I know other teams are looking for funding. I know of another team which has effectively borrowed money against all of its facilities in recent weeks. And that shows you the extent to which people are pretty desperate to make sure that they have the cash to survive in the relatively short term. And that, you know, I think when this all washes out, we could end up seeing some structural changes in teams, because once you start effectively mortgaging off team assets, you get into the realms of potentially selling equity in your team, or giving someone the right to take ownership of your team if you're unable to pay a loan back. So I think it's a very delicate moment for a lot of teams in Formula One. And I think actually McLaren have been pretty upfront about the fact that as a group, they've been looking for an injection of funds. They asked the UK government for an injection of funds, and that's not been accepted. So they're out there in the market looking for other ways to raise funding. And there are, you know, investment analysts looking at McLaren proposals at the moment to see, you know, whether this is an organisation worth backing. You'd have to say that on paper, you know, it should be possible for McLaren to raise the funding that they want. But of course, that supercar marketplace, which they serve through the McLaren Automotive division, is of course going through a pretty turbulent time as well, because of the, again, all the issues brought about by lockdown and coronavirus and the damage to the car industry.
If it wasn't going to work for Richard Branson, then there's not much chance for Formula One teams to get taxpayer money, is there? It's a really tricky situation, I think, for Formula One, because we know it's a moneyed sport. It's full of millionaires, in some case billionaires. But of course, the way Formula One teams work, they're not savers. They don't sit on giant cash reserves just waiting for a rainy day. They're spending their money all the time on people, performance, going racing. And when something like this happens, which shuts their outlets down, they haven't got all this money sitting around to just carry on as normal or pick things up afterwards. So as Mark says, a very, very delicate moment. And you could run through the grid and have a guess at you know, which teams are in better shape than others. It's not hard. But all of them will be feeling the pinch, no doubt.
As I say in my column, you know, ultimately this all comes down to people. Because to keep a team going, you've got to employ people. And if you're employing 300 or 600 or 800 or 1,000 full-time staff in a Formula One team, and you've got to pay those £50,000-£60,000 on average salaries every month, it takes a huge amount of cash. And I mean, going all the way back to my Jordan Grand Prix days, Eddie used to talk about, you know, keeping the lights turned on and the doors open, and that just to stand still, we needed a heck of a lot of money every year before we ever went racing. And this is where the teams are now at. They're burning their way through money just to keep their teams intact. No one wants to make people redundant. The government's furlough program has been, I would say, quite a lifesaver for many, many businesses in the UK, Formula One included. And again, it's been interesting. Some of the teams have publicly stated, yes, we have furloughed most of our staff. Some teams have had their leadership take pay cuts, had their drivers take pay cuts, and they've been quite open about that. Other teams have been a little bit more secretive about how they're getting through this current period. But the reality is that everyone is having to adjust to this very, very different world in which we live in. And Ben, exactly, you know, to your point, the teams don't sit on large amounts of cash saved up for a time like this, because frankly, no one saw a time like this coming. Everyone was pretty reliant on the fact that Formula One as a sport would keep on going and the pipeline of funding would always be there. That pipeline has a massive crack in it at the moment, and it's a question of whether the racing can resume soon enough to enable Liberty to set about repairing that flow of money and get the sport back on track. I will just, for one final point I'll say on this, and that is that it's just as well, I think, that Liberty are around and that they are the owners of Formula One at the moment, because they've been able to structure their quite complex global businesses in such a way to, as I say, put that money into Formula One and to safeguard the sport in the medium term. And so Liberty are very much focused on the survival, and then they're hoping for a bounce in the sport in 2021 and 2022 to get somewhere back to normal. But it's good that they've been around and that they do have the deep pockets that have been able to safeguard the immediate future of the sport.
Because in the past, Bernie Ecclestone would occasionally, provided he didn't think that the team in question was trying to pull a fast one, he was prepared to dip into his pockets and give teams an advance. But this is quite unprecedented, isn't it, to basically give everyone a sub? And as you say, it's a big game of which Shell is the peanut under, isn't it, at a corporate level, when you're moving around money from various businesses. It's interesting, the Sunday Times Rich List was published last weekend, and obviously we break out the smallest violin in the world as we learn that a lot of billionaires and millionaires are now sitting on slightly smaller cash piles, but there are still some high net worth individuals out there. Lawrence Stroll is one of those. We have a brief look at over the course of a couple of pages in this issue at the situation with Aston Martin as it's going to become next season. And as you wrote in your recent column, Mark, he's actually taken advantage of changing global circumstances to cut a better deal with Aston Martin to take more control of the company for perhaps a little bit less money. So on the one hand, assuming that he's going to continue to have deep pockets, they seem to be relatively safe as an organisation. Do we expect to see more of this kind of thing as, you know, the economic effects of the pandemic create opportunities for these slightly lower net worth than they used to be individuals to snap up what could just be distressed assets? If you've got teams mortgaging their factories, there are going to be some bargains out there, maybe.
Yeah, I think that's undoubtedly one of the likely scenarios that will evolve in the months ahead. There will be teams under pressure. There will be team shareholders who will say to themselves, actually, we need someone else to help us to carry the burden here, because if you've got two or three shareholders in your Formula One team and that you can see there's going to be a big cash call, you're going to need 50 million pumped in. Or, and I mean, for example, to keep a team going, if teams decide towards the end of this year they have to make people redundant, they've got to make those redundancy payments as well. Everything takes cash, and that's it. You need a lot of money there. So the Lawrence Stroll play on Aston Martin was very typical of someone of his kind of caliber. So he goes into a deal, they negotiate a price, they negotiate the terms. During the negotiation, Aston Martin share price is continuing to collapse. So eventually it gets to the point where Lawrence goes, actually, that deal is no longer good. I need a bigger share. I need more power. And then he ends up coming in as executive chairman. And coming in as executive chairman of Aston Martin, you know, for those who maybe might be unfamiliar with corporate structures, typically a chairman tends... It's quite popular these days for the chairman to be non-executive. So that essentially means that he acts as something of a sounding board and a mentor for the chief executive.
Niki Lauda's role.
Sorry?
Niki Lauda's role at Mercedes.
Niki Lauda's role.
Yeah, but I'm paying attention, teacher.
But as executive chairman, essentially, Lawrence Stroll is in the position of having the ability to call the shots. That's going to be something to watch very, very closely. Clearly, there's been a downward trajectory on the share price, which is why he's ended up taking it over. But coming into Formula One, there's kind of good news and bad news at the moment. The good news is that Lawrence Stroll really does hold all the cards in terms of what he wants to do with the Aston Martin brand in Formula One with Racing Point, and to make that effectively the works team. Not a sponsored team, but actually effectively the works team for Aston Martin. The bad news is, of course, that, again, the coronavirus has led to a complete collapse in Aston Martin sales. You know, in their growing markets like China, which is so important to them, and actually back in their heartlands here in Europe and in the UK, Aston Martin suffering the effects of, what was that, a 97% collapse in car sales during the month of April across the car industry in the UK. So Lawrence Stroll, whatever deal he struck, which will have been a very, very good deal, of course, he didn't know COVID-19 was going to take things over. So this will be, again, even for him, a very difficult time. And I just want to finish one other point, Stuart, to you, and that is that when we talk about millionaires and billionaires, well, of course, millionaires don't have a role to play in Formula One because they don't have enough money. When you talk about billionaires, the thing about billionaires coming into Formula One is because it eats up money at such a prodigious rate, for a billionaire, it can become quite a squeaky experience fairly quickly. And this is why, you know, we've talked before about the fact that, you know, Gene Haas, you know, 3 years into Formula One, yes, he's a billionaire, American businessman. But again, sooner or later, your accountant phones you up and says, you know, those billions that you have, well, actually, you don't have those billions anymore because Formula One is vacuuming up money at an extraordinary rate. So there's a lot of financial pressure across Formula One and lots of factors outside of Formula One that are really going to impact on the sport. And I do agree with you that it's not impossible to imagine teams being bought and sold now or over the summer or into the winter of this year, particularly if there have been cash crunches, which their existing shareholders have not been able to meet.
And some of the people flying in potentially to rescue those teams could be massive shysters, as chronicled in Nick Fry's recent book about the Braun GP experience. Some of the absolute nutcases, shysters, charlatans, mountebanks that rode in there. And even the people who did have money were complete pains in the backside. I've not seen a single recollection of the aforementioned Richard Branson's presence in Formula One that paints him in a good light. Everyone seemed to think that he was a complete jerk from beginning to end, not just him, his people as well. So I suppose maybe we don't want these billionaires coming in.
Well, I remember very well sitting in the offices of the late Martin Bahrain at Lola and receiving the phone call from Virgin to say, we have an offer for you if you're successful in getting an entry into Formula One. And we said, OK, what's the offer? And they said, well, the offer is we will allow you to call your team Virgin Racing. and then you will use the power of our brand to get the sponsorship so that all these sponsors will queue up because you call yourself Virgin Racing. And then I forget the figure. They said, we'll relieve you of about 20% of your sponsorship revenue. That will be our payment for giving you our brand. What do you reckon? And Martin and I had a very short conversation with him that idea. I mean, the principle of it all seemed to be, you know, you'll be lucky to have the Virgin brand. As poor John Booth and Graham Loudon found out, having the Virgin brand turned out to be of absolutely no value whatsoever for building their Formula One team. And actually, it was to their detriment, because the problem with having a big brand like Virgin in front of your team is everyone thought it was fully sponsored by Richard Branson. Wasn't benefiting you at all.
I found John Booth a remarkable individual. I gave him a lift into Monza. It would be before they even started, so it was when they were still scoping it out. So I mean, maybe 2009 Italian Grand Prix. And as we were sitting in traffic, he was telling me about, you know, drivers who had been perhaps disappointed by or he'd had greater hopes for. And I'll try and do an impression of him, but it might seem accurate.
Really? You're going to try and do John Booth?
It wouldn't be flat chat without a Cotter's impression, would it?
Yeah, okay. Let's go. Okay. He goes,
drum roll.
Pizzonia handled properly.
Alan Bennett.
So it's two Alan Bennett, isn't it?
That's not John Booth.
Alan Bennett. Yeah.
Oh, the lady parked a van in my road. No, Pizzonia.
You have one northern voice, Cotter's, and it is Alan Bennett.
Handled properly, Pizzonia would have been three-time world champion by now, and I'd be living on beach. And I kind of WTF'd at that, and I thought, Antonio Pizzonia, three-time world champion? You're kidding yourself, mate. So from that point of view, I was not massively surprised to see that team not cut it in Formula One. But yes, disappointing that the new blood of 2010 didn't make it. I remember doorstepping Martin Bahrain on his way out of the toilet in the Le Mans press room on the day
that was embarrassing.
well, it was that weekend when the successful and unsuccessful tenders for the new teams on the grid had been announced, and we were at Le Mans for the 24 hours.
I was at the Zandvoort Masters. I spoke to Booth, I think.
Oh, exactly. Because we all came together, didn't we, to do all these things. And I was sort of sitting, tapping away at my screen. And the editor of autosport.com at the time, who's a man from Kent, went, "Is that Martin Bahrain going into the bog?" It does appear to be indeed Martin Bahrain going into the bog. So I got him on the way out, as it were. Fortunately, he'd washed his hands.
Yeah, he won't be doing that kind of doorstepping for a while anymore, I think, in the post-COVID world.
Yeah, he was not very pleased. You know, his relief at not having to deal with Richard Branson was tempered by his disappointment.
I was very interested to hear John Booth say Pizzonia could have been a 3-time world champion, because my only kind of touch point with Pizzonia was when I had just joined Jaguar as they were about to transition into Red Bull.
He didn't roll you in a car, did he?
No, but I was in the office the day that we got the phone call to say that following a Formula One test in, I think it was in Barcelona, wasn't it? He had been put in an S-Type, if you remember the Jaguar S-Type. He'd been put in an S-Type.
My parents owned one.
Oh, well, there you go. And he was given, you know, three people are run around the track, and he forgot that the braking characteristics of a Jaguar S type were quite different from that of a Formula One car.
Essentially,
didn't brake for turn one, and over-ended the car. And the great thing is that Jaguar's superb PR team had onboard cameras inside. So if you want to watch it all, it's on YouTube.
It's still out there.
Formula One driver rolls Jaguar road car. Just go onto YouTube, have a look at it, and there's your potential 3-time world champion bringing his reputation to a sorry end in a road car.
The guy in the passenger seat was quite a handy racer in his own right and a good road tester. And you can see him.
Who was that?
Steve
then?
Sutcliffe from Autocar.
Oh. Okay, yeah. God, you know him.
Yeah, and you can see him. You can see the light bulb go off in his head way before Antonio puts the brakes on.
He was definitely doing through the passenger footwell braking, wasn't he?
The third brake pedal was being applied.
What a great dinner party story he has to tell about the time. You know, when he's a very elderly gentleman, his grandkids or great-grandkids will not believe him when he says, well, of course, I rolled at the first corner of Barcelona with a Jaguar Formula One driver. It'll seem very unlikely, but yeah, extraordinary. Poor old Antonio.
I suppose the big fear we have is getting back to topic is how many or whether we have a manufacturer flight again post whatever this looks like, because as you mentioned, Mark, the automotive industry is basically ground to a halt. I think I read a story in one of the tabloid newspapers that the highest selling model of car in the month of April was a little Tykes toy, one of which we have for our son, that you put kids in and they wheel themselves around. It sold several hundred units as parents grasped desperately for something to occupy their children during lockdown. And
that's what Ford need to do, sell a car with Flintstone holes in the floor.
That's exactly what it is. So if that's the state of play in the automotive market, yeah, we're going to need a quite substantial bounce back for teams like Renault, I'm thinking, even manufacturers like Honda, to want to stay involved. And how are they going to justify F1 programs when their core business is suffering so badly and the world is in potentially a forthcoming economic depression?
If Renault quits Formula One, you do realise, I hope Cyril realises that Cyril are beatable, that he's going to get lots of messages about the lack of commitment being shown to the sport of Formula One.
Yeah, this is a time for loyalty.
this is a time for loyalty and commitment. But it'll be interesting, because you do look at it and think, well, there can't really be a manufacturer in the world at the moment who is seeing Formula One as an absolute, or motorsport as an absolute essential. I think possibly with the exception of Ferrari. I think Ferrari do find Formula One essential to them, although apparently they are looking at, well, Binotto has said they're looking at Indy, aren't they, for potentially a way of keeping some of their staff employed.
Well, we've seen that before, haven't we?
They're suffering, aren't they, this time? That's the point. They're genuinely suffering. And if Ferrari's suffering to the point where considering alternative championships and spending much less money on drivers, then every other team on the grid has got problems of a magnitude higher than that, I think.
I do think that it's probably quite timely for the FIA and Liberty to have a conversation about opening the door to one or two new teams, maybe for 2022, 2023, just to see if there are any good independents out there who could put together the money to come in on a much reduced budget cap. And also, I do think that there's even more pressure now going to be on the FIA and on the teams to find ways to agree for the sharing of technical designs and resources so that you can keep that budget right down to a minimum. And I mean, I know of a couple of people who over the last 2 years have looked at doing Formula One, and oddly enough, they are now seeing this as potentially an opportunity, because if you don't need $300 million a year to do Formula One properly, if you can do it on a much reduced budget cap, suddenly it becomes a little bit more doable. So there are all kinds of opportunities, I think, that will come on the other side of this. But considering that everyone in financial circles is saying that the effect of the coronavirus is a much deeper recession than we saw in 2008 with the financial crisis, when we lost BMW, we lost Honda, we lost Toyota. I mean, the reality is it seems unlikely that the four car manufacturers, possibly five with Aston Martin, will remain completely unaffected by this.
Well, we can revisit that subject next month when we consider an issue that has an interview with Robert Kubica in it, because we spoke to him just a couple of weeks ago. But obviously that's for a future podcast. Well, gents, I'm afraid I'm going to have to disappear and speak to a video game designer in just a second. So it is time to bring this podcast to a conclusion. We'll be back next month with another edition of the world's best-selling Formula One magazine, available via subscription, via our website, via shops if you're allowed to go to, and via magsdirect.co.uk. I'm not sure I've said that often enough in that in the podcast today. So thank you very much to my guest, Ben Anderson.
Thank you, Connors. A pleasure as always.
As always. I mean, obviously, we have these meetings many times a week, but we don't get to speak to Mark that often, just monthly. Mark, great to have you again. Thanks very much. We'll see you in a month's time.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you very much for listening. This podcast has been produced by Martin Lee.